Polarization just keeps getting worse in Washington. It's as bad as they've ever seen it, and it seems to be making Americans very upset.
Impeach 45!
This is politics.
Impeach 45!
Is this where we want to set the bar for future presidents?
Clinton was the worst in history.
It was a vote along party lines that made President Clinton only the...
I'm not for gay marriage.
I believe marriage is between a man and a woman.
I believe marriage is between a man and a woman.
And so does
Barack Obama nor I support redefining the Constitution.
A limousine was set on fire downtown.
It's my decision.
Smoke could be seen for blocks away. And protesters hurled trash cans and flash bombs at the Washington. The bill is working intense partisan fighting.
Hey guys, welcome back to Bob and Weave. That's Bob Ruff.
That's me.
I'm Zach Weaver, the Weave.
Mm-hmm.
And we're happy to be back.
Yep. Thank you guys for putting up with us being taking Christmas off. I mean, hopefully you enjoyed the bonus content, the Bob and Weave minus the Weave,
mm-hmm.
with me and Mike and the Star Wars. And we may seem a little off talking about that. It's because we're recording this
before
we record that. So we're assuming that we're even going to record it.
Yeah, that's all right.
If there wasn't a Christmas bonus episode with me and Mike talking about Star Wars, then disregard.
Yeah, just pretend like this didn't happen.
Right.
So I know a lot of listeners have heard this phrase before, but today we're going to talk about something that we've kind of talked about, which is the presumption of innocence until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of a falsehood that is.
In a larger regard, you know, we're going to talk about Richard Jewell today.
Mm-hmm.
But with a broader scope, the innocence until proven guilty is something that I've said for years on the Truth and Justice podcast, really is a fallacy. And it's really, I think the biggest problem with our criminal justice system mm-hmm. is that everything, the entire system is written and designed around this presumption of innocence, that you're innocent until proven guilty. But the reality of it is, when you go into court, into a trial, and I've been a juror or a potential juror on several trials, the reality is that most people just automatically think that the defendant, is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking for that person to prove their innocence, as opposed to the way it's supposed to work, which is they're innocent and it's the prosecution's job to prove their guilt.
Especially when it's in the public eye and in the media,
mm-hmm.
which is what really drove this case, is the media coming out and saying, this is the individual. So everybody just jumped on board saying, yep, that's the guy. They got him.
Right. And to be clear, Richard Jewell, for those of you that aren't aware, he was a prime suspect in the 1996 Centennial Olympic Park bombing.
Mm-hmm.
He was never tried in court. He was cleared, but he sure as hell was tried in the court of public opinion.
And the big reason we're talking about this topic is it's back in the news.
Mm-hmm.
There was recently a movie released by Clint Eastwood called Richard Jewell about his life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that being said, Bob and I haven't seen the movie yet.
Right. So we thought about not doing this.
Yeah.
Which we'll see when we end if that would have been a better move. But the reason that we decided to do it was both of us were interested in the movie and want to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
But anytime I'm looking at a movie or viewing a movie that is based on a true event, I really want to know a lot about the event before I go watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Another example of that is if you guys have ever seen, which we should cover that topic sometime, Charles Manson.
Yes.
Because I went and saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a fantastic movie. At this point, now mind you, when I'm recording this, I'm 2 days away from when I'm going to see the new Star Wars. But at this point, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the best movie that I've seen in 2019.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was really good. But there's a big tie-in to the Charles Manson family.
I kind of half watched it last week, actually.
Oh, did you?
We had it on at the studio, and we all know how I watch movies at the studio.
Right, while
you're so it was on, tattooing. And I know that there was some stuff. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't realize it was related to Charles Manson until we put it on.
Right.
So that was pretty interesting. I'd like to actually watch it.
Yeah, I didn't either. And that was one of the instances where I watched the movie. It was like, oh, this is awesome. Now, Becky, my wife, knows a lot about Manson and the Manson murders and the Manson family. Because she did a report on it when she was in high school. So she was really catching a lot of the, we talked about in the Star Wars thing, the Star Wars episode where for me, if there's little nuggets, little Easter eggs that should be a reference to something, if I don't get it, I get really mad. Like when I'm in the room and there's an inside joke. So I was like, oh, damn it. So after I watched that movie, I went and studied a lot about Charles Manson. And so that's kind of why we decided to go ahead and do this. Even though we haven't seen the movie yet, I'm going to be researching Richard Jewell before I go see it. And so either if you are a viewer that has a viewer or listener, if you're either listening or watching on YouTube, if you haven't seen Richard Jewell yet, this should give you some good background. We're not going to spoil anything in the movie because we're just talking about what actually happened. And if you have already watched it, maybe this would be a good place for you to get some of the real background in the Richard Jewell case.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few elements that I think we can kind of use as our basis to go through this.
Mm-hmm.
One, you have what the event was, the incident, the bombing, and then what happened to Richard Jewell. And then also what's really interesting, the part of the story that most people don't know was the arrest and conviction of Eric Robert Rudolph, mm-hmm. who was the man that actually did the bombing.
Which is amazing to me because I remember growing up. So at the time of this, I was like 11, 12
mm-hmm.
when this bombing happened. So I that's definitely in my memory bank. I remember this well when this happened.
Right.
And I remember like immediately when they came out and said that the security officer, at that time, I didn't even know his name, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't have remembered his name. But I remember them saying the security officer is the prime suspect, and it sounded like he did it.
Right.
And then honestly, up until we talked about this, I didn't realize he still didn't do it. And I think really? There's a lot of people that are the same way as I am.
Yeah, everybody connects Richard Jewell. I mean, I know it was the summer before my senior year of high school when this happened.
Okay.
So I remember, I remember that it was taking up all the news,
mm-hmm.
which was a weird thing because it was during the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
which I think that's another topic for another day too. But the Olympics don't have to me the pull or draw in the interest of people as much today as they did back then. And I think that's maybe because of technology and our easy access to media now.
Yeah, that could be. I also think that with those games in the United States, it helped draw more media. It helped draw more interest from us Americans.
Right.
Because as an American, and I don't mean this just me, but a lot of people, like, we don't care if it's not here. You know what I mean? Like, we're very selfish when it comes to that.
Well, we are now, maybe, but when I was a kid, like, we couldn't wait.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when the Olympics were on, I remember specifically, I guess it would have been the 88 Olympics. The only reason I remember that is because it was the year we were building our new house. So I was 9 years old during that. And I remember just being any free time. If we were in front of a TV during that time, we were all glued to the TV watching the Olympics.
Okay.
That's all anyone was talking about. This is before the 24-hour news cycle. This was before, CNN and Fox News were running 24 hours a day. It was, sitcoms at prime time at 8 o'clock. You had a couple of channels you were watching.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what everyone was watching, was the Olympics. Whereas the last few Olympics, like, I haven't watched any of them. I just don't care. I don't know where they were at, or it's not a thing that interests me anymore.
Well, so the things that I can remember from the Olympics is moments. So like 92 was the Dream Team.
Right.
Everybody watched the Dream Team.
Yeah.
No one could probably tell you anything else that happened in the 92 Olympics.
Right.
But we had the Dream Team, and everybody knows the Dream Team.
Which was, that was the year where professional
basketball
players were allowed to play in the Olympics.
Yep.
And so you had, gosh, I still have that poster, the Dream Team poster is still on my wall of my bedroom at my parents' house, which is my dad's office now.
Yeah. That's awesome. So total side note, there's a Dream Team documentary that is wonderful. It follows the Dream Team. And there's a part in there where John Stockton gets off the bus and is walking through the crowd and no one notices who he is. Because John Stockton, if anybody knows, is a little bitty white guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he walks completely through the crowd, never gets noticed, gets exactly where he needs to go. Yeah. And everybody's pissed off because none of the other players can do that.
Gosh, who was it? It was John Stockton, David Thomas? Was it? No, not David Thomas. David Robinson.
David Robinson.
Was Dennis Rodman one of them?
No. Jordan Pippen.
Okay.
Isaiah Thomas wasn't on. There was a big deal with Isaiah Thomas about them not wanting him on the Dream Team.
Uh-huh.
Karl Malone, John Stockton, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson. Trying to think. Christian Laettner was the only college player on the team.
Okay.
But they just left him on the bench the whole time.
Duke, right?
He played for Duke at the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only collegiate
right
athlete on the team. But he literally just sat on the bench the whole time.
And everybody watched. But that was, I guess my point in bringing this up is you have to understand there's people now, probably your age and younger, especially like Mike's age, you know, somebody that's 30 years old or younger, especially, that may not quite understand how big of a deal this was.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just don't think the Olympics had that. You know, the last Olympics, it wasn't the talk of the town. Everybody wasn't buzzing about the Olympics. The last time I remember anybody getting real excited was when Michael Phelps was like breaking every record ever. Mm-hmm. But they were just interested in Michael Phelps, you know, more so than the Olympics. But back in 96, like the world stopped. And it wasn't, for me at least, it wasn't just when it was in the United States. It was just when the Olympics came on, the world stopped and everybody, every bar you went into had the Olympics on every screen.
Okay.
And every, you know, any restaurant you were into, that's all anybody was talking about is how many medals we got and who won this or who won that.
Well, and my thing with the 96 Olympics, talking about this Olympics, was the female gymnastics team won gold. And it was the first time they'd won gold in years. And it was a big, what I remember from that.
What year was the whole Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing?
That was before. That must have been the 92 or before.
Must have been, yeah.
Because it wasn't the 96.
I remember it, but I would have.
And that was the Winter Olympics.
Uh-huh, right.
So it would have been 94.
Right.
Or 90.
That's right. Different Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, so like all that stuff was really big. So when the Olympics, it was a big deal. It was coming to the United States. The Olympics were in Atlanta that year.
Mm-hmm.
And the world was watching. And this was like this big time. It was a different world. We talk all the time, or at least we kind of started the show talking about, you know, how the world has become so divided and there used to be this unity there. It was a time where America, at least, I can't speak for other parts of the world, was really united during the times of the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
and it was a big deal.
Yeah.
So on July 27th of that year, during the Olympics, in the Centennial Olympic Park, which was kind of set up as kind of the town square for the Olympics, I mean, people would travel from across the world to watch the Olympics, and of course, tons of Americans there because it was in America.
Mm-hmm.
People were every city was fighting for the Olympics to come there because there was so much money brought in from all these people. And so there was a concert that night. The band was called Jack Mack and the Heart Attack, which I feel like I should know them, but I
never heard of them.
Mm-mm. But everybody was gathering around for this big concert. And all of a sudden, an evacuation starts.
Okay.
There was somebody, all we knew at the time was a security guard noticed this like green army backpack type thing
mm-hmm.
that had been placed in the kind of in the middle of all this next to like a, it was like an NBC radio tower or something.
Okay.
And he alerted somebody from the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, or maybe it was the FBI, but he alerted a law enforcement official that this backpack was there. They alerted the bomb squad and started evacuating people and saved thousands of lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the bomb does end up detonating.
Yeah.
And one person was killed, and I want to make sure that we include her name. Her name was Alice Hawthorne. She was 44 years old from Albany, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
She was killed. One of the nails, it was a pipe bomb. One of the nails went right through her head and killed her. Someone else, it was a Turkish cameraman.
Yeah, I think had a heart attack while running or something.
Running to.
Was it running to or from? I didn't know.
I thought it was from, but when I was reading, I've got an article in front of me here that says a Turkish cameraman of Turkish Radio and Television Corporation, Mali, not going to try to pronounce that last name, had a fatal heart attack while running to the scene, which makes sense.
He's a cameraman. He's trying to get footage.
Right, trying to get footage of it. And there was some footage of it. A few people did get video of the bomb actually going off. But 111 people were injured in that attack.
And I know that the security guard, the one that found it, was really touted as a hero at the beginning.
Right.
Which happens to be Richard Jewell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was touted for saving all these people. And then that's where it spiraled out of control for him.
Yeah. Well, really, ultimately, the news media destroyed Richard Jewell's life.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it goes before that. And I hate to say this because I'm, you know, I have friends that were part of this unit. I don't know if they were at that time or involved in this, but and I'm a big fan of the FBI's behavioral analysis unit. The profilers like Jim Clemente, who was a very good friend of mine, the FBI profilers started things in motion.
Yeah,
for Richard Jewell, and that started with there was a tip that came in, I think, to the GBI from a former employer of Richard Jules.
Is that the Piedmont College?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think they kind of had a grudge against him. They really thought he was just overzealous. He would raid dorm rooms for drinking. He was a security guard there at one point.
Right.
And they had fired him. And he would do a lot of weird things. They said he would write epic reports for very minor refractions. Like he wanted to be a police officer so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what happens is this, the president of, his name is Raymond Cleary. He was the president of the Piedmont College, contacted investigators and tells him that, you know, Richard Jewell was overzealous. Basically, the way I took it was they told him this guy was like a wannabe cop,
mm-hmm.
and he was creating something out of nothing all the time, and that's why they fired him. The FBI gets that, and they had profiled kind of what they would call like a lone wolf bomber.
Okay.
Now, to be fair, I don't think the FBI was wrong, and as it turns out, they weren't. As far as what the profile of this bomber would be, mm-hmm. They said it would be somebody that didn't have a big social circle, probably socially awkward, probably somebody maybe that wants to be a police officer. I think that's the part they got wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be kind of a lone wolf type person that would do this.
I think the big thing is when it got leaked that they thought he fit the description, or that they believed he fit the description.
Right.
And that's the big term that I've seen throughout this whole case, is that it was leaked.
Right.
So what does that mean? Does that mean somebody said it when they weren't supposed to? Does that mean somebody provided a document when they weren't supposed to?
Yeah, I don't know. And maybe the movie gets into some of that, how the information got from the FBI to the media. I know there was another misstep, maybe not a misstep, but there was someone, they had CCT camera footage, surveillance footage from around the bombings.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw the person in the footage that they thought could have been the bomber. But it was too grainy.
Yeah, because we've already talked about how well surveillance footage is from that time period.
Right, yeah.
Or even today. Some of the surveillance footage from today is garbage.
I just saw a meme about that, like on Instagram just a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Where it was like, you know, 2019 surveillance footage image and 2019 camera phone images.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, how is this possible?
Yeah.
That they're you know, that different and not clear. But so they that was too grainy for them to use it. But then someone made a composite sketch.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if it was taken off that grainy image or if it was from a witness, but the FBI chose not to release it and not to release any names of the suspects.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
And so, like you said, for 4 or 5 days, I think it was a few days, Richard Jewell was the big hero. Everybody, yeah. You know, he was in all the news, you know, he was. He spotted the bag. He took action. He evacuated the area. One person was killed and 111 were injured, but it would have been thousands.
I guess he was immediately contacted for a book deal.
Yeah.
Like in the days preceding or just following
that.
Yeah, immediately contacted for a book deal. And he was going through his lawyer, and then somebody contacted his lawyer about him being
a suspect.
A suspect.
Yeah. And so that's what happened. So the FBI is creating this profile. They get this new information about Richard Jewell. They with his old job, and they say he fits the profile. Somehow that gets leaked to the media.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it was a leak. I thought they had just announced
it. Well, and the reason, I mean, I've seen it as a leak a couple times, but in 97, the U.S. Attorney General, Janet Reno, at the time said she apologized and expressed deep regret for the leak. I mean, she used that term.
Okay.
For the leak, in which caused the presumption of guilt on him.
Right. Well, what happened with it was the news media ran with it.
Yeah.
And so they come out and say, we finally have a suspect. Because they had, the FBI nor the GBI had indicated that they had any suspects.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then all of a sudden, they finally have a suspect, and they put it out, and then they ran with it 24/7. Like, if the news was on, and I do remember this.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the switch from him being the hero to the guy, and it was, I remember being at school talking about, like, holy shit, did you see that guy that they were saying was the big hero? He's the one that put the bomb there.
Yeah, I think the Atlanta Journal of Constitution or Atlanta Journal Constitution was the first one that really put it out there. And their headline was like, Olympic hero, now prime suspect in bombing. You know what I mean? They put it right out there immediately.
And then the media immediately flooded to his house. He was like under siege at his house for
weeks. They said
weeks. Somebody
put his phone number out there. So he was receiving thousands of phone calls a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just absolutely ruined his life. Now, real quick, back to the Olympics. That was another big deal because they had to make a decision. There's been a bombing.
Mm-hmm.
100 people plus are injured. There's a woman dead. Do we continue the Olympics? And they ultimately decided to go ahead with the Olympics.
Yeah.
But the Richard Jewell stuff was way overshadowing the media coverage of the Olympics. You know, I don't remember much about those Olympics other than this. Because like I said, I remember being at school and everybody was just, you know, remember, did you have Channel 1 still when you were in school?
I think so.
I think that's a national thing. A lot of you listening probably had Channel 1. But that's all they were talking about on Channel 1 every day. For those of you from a different country that don't know, Channel 1 was like a short 5 to 10 minute news thing aimed for kids that we would watch at the beginning of our school days.
So all I remember from 96 was Muhammad Ali lighting the torch. That was a big deal for us because Muhammad Ali was a local to us.
Right.
The female gymnastics team, that was a big deal. And then this bombing.
Right.
But again, like I said, once this bombing happened and they put him out as a suspect, that's the last I remember of it.
Mm-hmm.
And up until we researched it, I still didn't realize that he wasn't the one that did it.
Yeah.
I feel really bad about, but I think a lot of people are that way.
Yeah. Well, and that's why Clint Eastwood made the movie. And I saw an interview the other day on social media somewhere, Richard Jewell's wife, because Richard Jewell has passed away.
Mm-hmm. He passed away in 2007.
Okay. His wife did an interview talking about the movie. And she said, for the most part, it was pretty accurate.
Okay.
And she talked about some of the terror and, you know, even later on in his life, decade later, that he was still suffering from, because there's most people like you, all they remembered was Richard Jewell did this.
Yeah.
Because he was exonerated just in a couple, wasn't it like October of that year?
Yeah, I believe it was like late October of that year.
Yeah, I found it here. So October 26th. I'm reading right here off this page, but it says the investigating U.S. attorney Kent Alexander, in an extremely unusual act, sent Jewell a letter formally clearing him, stating, quote, based on the evidence developed to date, Richard Jewell is not considered a target of the federal criminal investigation into the bombing on July 27th, 1996. So it was the number 81 days is sticking in my head.
Okay.
Because I feel like maybe there was a book or something that was called 81 Days of Terror.
Oh, that does sound right. Yeah.
It could be wrong. But something. But yeah, so it didn't go on for that long. He became a suspect for a couple months.
Mm.
The news media was just going after this guy. Like, he was the guy. He was not figuring out what happened. And the FBI did think he was a suspect. I mean, there was reports that the FBI like tried to convince him to waive his constitutional rights to an attorney.
Well, I know they took hair samples and they did a couple other things. They did a voice sampler of some sort. I mean, they did a couple different things.
Oh, yeah. There was a part where they had him say something over and over again. I don't remember what. Oh, gosh. I wish I could remember that. Because there was something that they believed the bomber had said.
Okay.
Or they had recorded of them saying. Maybe. Did they call in?
They did call about 13 minutes before the bomb went off.
Okay.
To say that they had planted a bomb.
Okay, that's what it was. So the actual bomber called and told them, I planted a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were having Richard Jewell say whatever this guy said to do a voice comparison.
Yeah.
But it seems like the FBI knew pretty quickly that he wasn't the guy. You know, that he wasn't. But they were, in an investigative strategy, we're keeping a lot of things under wraps, which included telling people that it wasn't Richard Jewell.
Yeah.
And so it was, like I said, October 26th when they finally publicly cleared him.
But by that time, the damage has been done with the media.
Yeah, his life was ruined at that point. And he ended up suing. I don't think he won. Do you know if he won any of the lawsuits? I know one of them.
No, he won multiple. So against Piedmont College, he sued them.
Okay.
And he received an undisclosed amount of money.
Uh-huh.
So they probably settled out of court.
Right.
He sued NBC, and he got $500,000 from NBC.
Okay.
With the New York Post, they settled for an undisclosed amount. And then CNN was an undisclosed amount as well.
Okay.
The big one was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the first one that dropped it.
I thought he lost that one.
He did. Okay. That's the one that went on for a long time. That one actually went on until after he had passed away. That one wasn't settled until 2011.
Okay.
And the judge sided with them, saying that because the articles in their entirety were substantially true at the time of the published, even though the investigators' suspicions were ultimately deemed unfounded.
Right. And what I had read is because they were always clear in every reporting mm-hmm. to say that he is considered a suspect by
yeah.
the GBI or FBI, which was true. In order for it to be defamation, it has to be untrue.
Yep. So the judge sided with him on that one.
Right. And sounds like rightly so, but this is something that I have to worry about all the time with not being sued. That's obviously part of it. But for me, just as a conscientious human mm-hmm. in what I do on Truth and Justice, you know, just recently we had, you know, we've received a string of tips about people in our season 7 case. And I have to make a decision every time, like, do I release these names? Mm-hmm. There's nothing that says I can't.
Yeah.
So we had a tip where a woman called in and said, she knows these three guys stole this car that may or may not be connected. Well, I made the decision because there's no indication. I looked these guys up. None of them seem to have any criminal records past that. One of them passed away, but two of them seem to be outstanding citizens,
yeah.
good people. So I decided unless I were to find something that actually indicates they were involved, we censored out all of their names. Mm-hmm. And we had to make those decisions on the fly because nobody likes that.
Yeah.
Nobody likes to listen to the podcast and beep, beep, you know, every time somebody's name's being said. But then the next week we have another tip and those guys, I did release their names mm-hmm. partially because their names were in the public records for this case.
Yeah.
They were in the case file. So anybody had access to them. Both of them do have extensive criminal records. Both of them were convicted of committing other crimes, but I have to be – or very similar crimes, but I have to be very, very careful. Again, both for journalistic standards and my own just conscience mm-hmm. to only report the facts.
Yeah.
Meaning I can say this person did do this, he did do this, and this person alleges that they did that. You leave it up to you to decide if they actually did it.
Yeah, but you can't put that person as the suspect.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can say, in my opinion, I believe this person is a suspect.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people that follow me and will take whatever word I say as the truth.
Yep. But that's the killer.
Yeah. So I have to be very, very careful when I do that. And that's what it sounds like the Atlanta Journal or whatever that was a little more careful about that than all these other ones.
Mm-hmm. That is what it sounds like.
Yeah. But then again, they settled out of court, so they could have just been enough's enough.
You got to think some of those big companies like NBC, the New York Post, CNN, you know, at what point are they going to fight? How much are they going to fight? What's a lawsuit going to cost? You know, what going to court, what's it going to cost them?
Right.
Over settling. There's a lot of big companies that will settle just to make it go away, even if they could possibly win.
Yeah. You know,
just so it doesn't bring up everything.
Well, there's also the bad press they don't want to deal with.
Yeah.
And so you notice a lot of those say an undisclosed amount of money. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when a lawsuit settles, that's the deal. Like, we will give you this much.
Yeah.
But in exchange for that, you are never allowed to talk about this again.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about that in previous cases. Like when the Epstein, you know, they had signed non-disclosure agreements.
Right.
In a case we didn't talk about, like R. Kelly, like all of his victims had signed non-disclosure agreements. So they paid him money. Now they can't talk about it. And if they talk about it, they have to give the money back.
Right. Yeah. So that's definitely what happened here. But the thing with Jewel was, even after he was cleared, first of all, a lot of people didn't believe it mm-hmm. because you don't want to, right?
Yeah.
You know, as a different time. This is a different time. It's almost a different world ago without the media. Internet. Was in 96 was around. Dial-up internet was around. Mm-hmm. Not very many people had it. I didn't have it.
Yeah.
I didn't have any. I didn't have internet until I got to college.
I'm trying. I would say I probably had the internet in 97. That's probably the first time we had the internet.
Yeah. Sounds about right. So I graduated in 97. I knew of the internet. I would use it at school.
Yeah.
And I had one friend who had the internet. And so two friends, I remember. Because I learned about email, and so I would go to my, here's a little side story, I would go to my friend David's house. I was visiting my aunt, I think, and I was using AOL Messenger, which was bananas mm-hmm. to us at the time. And that was in 97. And so we meet these girls on AOL Messenger, and then, you know, so we would go over and log in and chat with them, and then they started sending emails. I'm like, I had to make an email address. So the thing was, dial-up internet was an actual phone line mm-hmm. for all you young whippersnappers that don't know that.
Yep.
And so my friend and we live in kind of a rural area. So the closest dial-up connection that we could get to was in South Bend, and he was in Buchanan, which was long distance.
Oh no!
Remember long distance?
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So his mom had a little cup on the table, and you had to put a dime in for every minute you use her internet.
That's awesome.
Because they had to pay 10 cents a minute for long distance to use the internet. So you'd log in, check your email, send one. And if it was 5 minutes, you had to put 50 cents in the cup.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That is funny. I don't want to say I forgot about long distance, but I've kind of forgot about long distance.
Right. Well, my first home that I bought. So I bought my first house in 99. So I'd gotten married. We moved back here. And I was at that point, you know, I had lived with some internet when I was living in Colorado in a bigger city. Like, I want internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought a house in Niles.
Okay.
Instead of Buchanan, which is where I'm from, which is where I live now, where I wanted to live.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't live in Buchanan because Buchanan still had to pay long distance for internet.
Oh, geez.
And Niles was not long distance from Niles to South Bend.
You know, it's funny thing about, because now that I'm thinking about it, my first girlfriend didn't live close, and she lived in the next town over, and it was long distance. Mm-hmm. And I can remember my parents throwing a fit, and the
relationship doesn't last long.
It was like, you get to have 5 minutes on the phone each night. You know, that's it. When you're trying to, you know, you're in that period of wanting to talk for hours.
Right.
People don't do that anymore, I don't think.
No, because they just text. Like, again, like, it's such a different world. I'm like, I know I'm getting way off the topic, but it's like, they're kind of fond memories.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of the, you know, before texting, before Twitter, before Facebook, before email.
Got on that kitchen phone that had that long curly cord, and you would like walk around the corner so no one could hear you, but you still had.
I just sit in our pantry. So we had the same thing. We had the kitchen phone like that, and right around the corner from it, we had a pantry where we, and like half of it was shelves and the other half was open.
Yeah.
Where you put like your brooms and mops, and the dog food went there. And I would pull the dog food out, and I would slide and sit in there and slide the little door shut so I could have some privacy. To sit and talk on the phone.
That's awesome.
And which also made it for when my dad decided it was, you were done talking on the phone. He'd just walk over and click. So anyway, Katie, I'm going to be seeing you at school and click. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Oh, that's funny.
But so, you know, that I think a lot of that factors into, I don't think this would happen in the same way today as it happened then.
Mm-hmm.
Because number one, the news cycle is so freaking fast now.
Yeah.
Because everything's so closely connected, you know, and that's, I've heard some theories jumping back to the Epstein episode. And I've even seen some memes that show like Epstein with Prince Andrew, which, by the way, we didn't even talk about after that episode, that his mama canceled his birthday party.
Yeah. There's some, we need to follow up on that episode.
Yeah, like he had to step down from his role as the Duke or whatever his role was.
Yeah.
And then the Queen canceled his birthday party. But anyway, there's all these memes out there with pictures of like Epstein and Prince Andrew, Epstein and Bill Clinton, Epstein and Donald Trump. And they're like, what happened to this? Oh, this is what happened to this. And they show the impeachment that's happening right now.
Oh.
Have you ever seen the movie Wag the Dog?
No.
Awesome movie. It's an incredible movie. But that's the basis of the movie is where the government would create things to distract from something bad.
Okay.
So in that movie, I don't remember what's going on, but they create a fake war.
Oh, geez.
To get the American people not to concentrate on whatever the scandal was at the time.
That's real tinfoil hatty right now, but I've heard that a lot, even with things when they talk about like mass shootings.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, the government created this. What are they trying to hide?
Yeah.
You know, that's really tinfoil-y, but.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, we do need to, I've been hesitating because it's so damn divisive. But at some point, we need to talk about the impeachments.
Okay.
Or the impeachment hearings that are actually happening. So we're recording this on the, what's today? The
18th.
18th. So you're hearing this a couple weeks after we recorded it, but there's hearings today. When I went in for lunch, they were up on the news.
Oh, really?
Having more hearings on the impeachment. It's just going to be a hard one to navigate. I hope our listeners are people that can be open-minded because it's going to be difficult, because if you think the impeachments are a bad idea, then you're getting pegged as a Trump supporter.
Yeah.
And, or if you think they're a good idea, you're a dirty Democrat or whatever, you know, but anyway, we need to get back to this topic. That was your free bit for today, as usual. But we do need to cover that. And we will. I'll make Zach talk about the whole thing.
So back to this topic, and we were talking about this, you know, we talked about the media pushing this out there and saying he was guilty, and that's what kind of led everybody to believe he was guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I don't know how well it was done, but when the FBI did clear him, you know, I don't think there was a lot of media coverage going out and going, oh, we fucked up, you know.
No, and that's what I'm getting at with the news cycles. Mm-hmm. Like they're now, like I said, today this wouldn't have happened because there's a new next big thing because the world's so small now, right? That takes everybody. But at that time, there wasn't. Like everybody's looking to fill pages in the newspaper.
Yeah.
They're looking to fill time on the news. And they had this great story that was great for ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't want to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, I think that they continued on.
Not that magazines are a huge thing anymore, but with magazines, they used to do it. They used to have a corrections section. They would put out an article and then they would have a corrections section.
Yeah, buried on page 12.
But that's exactly it. It was buried. It was the tiniest little thing. So they would put these huge articles out and then have, oh, yep, this was wrong. But no one would pay attention to that.
Whoopsie.
Whoops.
Yeah. So, but let's get into the part that I think most people don't know, which is there was a man convicted of this.
Yeah.
His name was Eric Robert Rudolph, and the guy was a nut job. He actually did three other bombings.
Okay. It sounded like he came on the radar about 98, so it's a couple years after the bombing.
Right. Well, yeah. So around 98, he wasn't even a suspect, I don't think. But then in early 97, there were two more bombings in Atlanta.
Now, one was like an abortion clinic.
Right.
And the other one was like a lesbian nightclub.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was the abortion clinic and lesbian nightclub in the Atlanta area. And then there was another bombing in another abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
And it was from those that the FBI, through forensics, were able to match shrapnel, the bomb-making materials. And that's where they realized all four were connected.
And that's probably, that's all, what, post-Unabomber, right?
Yeah, it was Unabomber 93-ish?
Yeah, it was early 90s. So, I mean, they've obviously, I don't want to say perfected it, but they've come down with formulas on how to collect bombs and how to make sure that they're the same. So, I mean, they definitely figured out that this guy was the guy.
Right. But they didn't know who the guy was.
Yeah.
But they got in, I think they, in one of those, they found, they got a partial plate. All it says here is they got, the FBI found some crucial clues at those other bombings.
Okay.
And I know one of them was a partial license plate. And then the license plate and some other clues led them to the identity of Eric Robert Rudolph as a suspect, but they couldn't catch him. He actually disappeared into the Appalachian Mountains.
Whoa.
For years. Like he did. And as a matter of fact, when I was researching this, I wish I had the link here. I will put it up on the screen here on the YouTube video. And I'll try to put it in the episode description for the audio podcast. But I came across a documentary online, but it's not on any streaming services.
Hmm.
It's like, it was like a website with a 57-minute documentary.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And it's on Eric Rudolph.
Yeah. It's called like in the Hills or something like that.
Okay. Don't isolate this, but I was super fascinated by the Unabomber for the longest time.
Got it.
Yeah. Like that's why I didn't watch that show, the Manhunt, because I realized it wasn't a documentary. And I was like, yep, they're going to fuck this up. I don't want to watch it.
Well, I can't find it. So. But I will find it and I'll put the information up for all our viewers and listeners. But so I didn't watch it. What I was looking for, I was getting ready to do my workout this morning.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if there's a documentary out there about this, I'll watch it while I'm working out. But I couldn't. It was just like on a website. But yeah, so he disappeared into the Appalachian Mountains, which I guess they said he was familiar with from his youth.
Mm-hmm.
And then on May 5th of 1998, the FBI named him as one of their 10 most wanted fugitives.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever been in the Appalachian Mountains, it's thick. You know,
I never have been.
Plenty of places to be. And it's, you know, I'm probably going to get reamed for this that I don't know, but it's like 1,400 miles long.
Is it?
Yeah. It runs from, I want to say, Georgia to Maine.
Right. All along the East Coast. Yeah. And I think he was in, I want to say, North Carolina.
Okay.
Yeah. He was arrested after 5 years on the run on May 31st, 2003 in Murphy, North Carolina.
Okay.
And it's funny. So he's in the FBI's top 10 most wanted fugitives. They had a $1 million reward out for this guy. He eludes the U.S. law enforcement agency for 5 years, and he gets arrested by a rookie cop.
Oh, geez.
A guy named Jeffrey Scott Postel of the Murphy Police Department behind a Save-A-Lot store at like 4 in the morning. He was on a routine patrol and thought it was a robbery in progress. Catches the guy and arrests him. I don't know if he realized it was him or whatever, but it turns out this is like on the FBI's top 10 most wanted.
Yeah. It seems like it seems like there's a lot of people that get busted for that, where it's like there's some notorious criminal and they get caught for something silly, or not even caught, but they just get, you know, picked up for a broken tail light.
Like Ted Bundy.
Yeah. Like Ted Bundy, like mm-hmm. just silly stuff.
Yep. Well, he's another one we should cover sometime. Now, I know you have, you said you were really obsessed kind of with the Unabomber investigation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Ted Bundy is one that just fascinates me.
Oh, I'd love to do it.
Not just him as a psychological study mm-hmm. of a psychopath, but also the whole investigation and him. Did you know he escaped prison twice?
Yes, I did know that.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
It's a cool story. But anyway,
speaking of the Unabomber, I do have a cool person we could talk to about that. So we'll keep that in mind.
Who is it?
I have a client who used to work as a mail inspector through Chicago, and that was like the first case when he started that he had to work on.
Oh,
he finished up his career working through the anthrax stuff in Washington D.C.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really cool guy.
Wow, that does sound interesting. I'm about to name drop, but is it cooler than Jim Fitzgerald, who happens to be a friend of mine?
No.
The profiler that caught the Unabomber?
I'll give you his name, but you won't believe me his name, so.
Why won't I believe you?
Because it's Tom Brady.
But not that Tom Brady.
Oh,
the other Tom Brady.
Different Tom Brady.
There's the Tom Brady that's a football player, mm-hmm. and then there's the one other one
yeah.
that works at the post office.
Yeah.
That would be cool. We could probably, yeah, him, or like we may be able to get Jim Fitzgerald. But if he's local, that'd be better because he can sit in.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, getting back to this as we kind of bring this to a close. So this is what happened. He finally gets arrested after 5 years on the run. That's five years. So it was 2003. So that's 5 years after 98, after they figured out it was him. So you have 2 years of them not knowing who did it.
Yeah.
5 years after they name him as the suspect, before he finally gets caught, he ended up pleading out to all of them in exchange for to have the death penalty being taken off the table.
Mm-hmm.
So he's serving 4 life sentences, and he was a nut job. He said basically he hates the government.
Yeah.
He thought that the Olympics were that they were trying to bring social. Well, what does it say here in his statement? Under the protection and auspices of the regime in Washington, millions of people came to celebrate the ideals of global socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And so his idea was to stop the Olympics. He thought if he bombed them, they would cancel it.
Yeah, or postpone it. And he really wanted to show how weak we were.
Right. He literally said he wanted to embarrass our government.
Yeah.
That one person could derail the Olympics when they brought it into the United States. Also, apparently not a big fan of the gays.
Yeah, apparently.
He said that he was, you know, he was the reason he the abortion clinics and the lesbian nightclub was because he was against abortion and against homosexuality.
Yeah.
His sister, though, and I think this is a good place to
side note, you know who's not getting abortions?
Who?
Gay people.
True. Yeah. There's a weird combination of people not to like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Side note, sorry.
Good point, Zach. So the best part about this is, I mean, so to be clear, obviously Richard Jewell was an innocent man that had his life ruined
mm-hmm.
primarily. First of all, there was a leak from the FBI, which as now in 2019, we know leaks from the FBI, not that uncommon.
Yeah, we're learning more and more about that.
Yeah. And then the news media irresponsibly destroyed this man's life. The real killer's name was Eric Robert Rudolph, and the best thing is his former sister-in-law, Deborah Rudolph, she gave a statement where she talked about the irony of Rudolph's plea deal because it putting him in the custody of a government he hates. So her quote was, "Knowing that he's living under government control for the rest of his life, I think that's worse for him than death." She said that to the San Diego Union-Tribune in 2005.
So one last side note that has nothing to do with any of it.
Okay.
It's weird how the mind plays tricks on you when it comes to age.
Uh-huh.
So I remember this happening, and I remember it being like an adult, like it was an older guy. It was an adult security guard that found this.
Right.
And it was an old guy. You know, that's my how my mind plays, because I was 11, 12.
Right.
And now as I like research this and look back at the date, he was 33. That's 2 years younger than I am now.
Yeah.
Like, shit.
It doesn't feel so old anymore.
No,
does
it doesn't.
Yeah, that's a common thing. It's funny you said 33. It just jarred my memory. I had an uncle who I was very, very close to. Still miss him to this day. My Uncle Brian died at 33 years old.
Yeah.
And I was same age difference, very similar to what you're talking about. I was 11 when he died. And I remember like he was like my adult, grown up, older uncle.
Yeah.
And now I'm 40. And really for like that for me, sometimes it hits me. It's like how devastating it is, like how much of his life.
Yeah.
He had like, because if I look at what I did between the time I was 33 to the time I'm now 40 years old, almost 41 years old, that there's a lot of life to live just in that little time span.
Absolutely. And Richard Jewell passed away at 44. So, I mean, he passed away really young.
Do you know how he died?
He had heart failure from complications of diabetes.
Okay.
So I can imagine that, you know, he probably had diabetes and was going through, but this probably did not help.
I'm sure not. As a matter of fact, I think his wife said something to that effect.
Yeah.
In the interview that I saw, she said that he, you know, this destroyed his life, and she believes ultimately led to his death. So that is our episode on the dangers of presuming guilt.
Yep.
Remember, everybody, if you're ever sitting in a jury box, that defendant is innocent until proven guilty. Zach, thanks for being my friend, buddy.
Love you, buddy.
Love you too, man. Bob and Weave is an NBI Studios production, produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and music by Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com. The artwork and our logo was created by Zach, and the video editing was done by me. You can connect with us on all forms of social media at Bob Weave Pod. And if you'd rather watch than listen, check out the Bob and Weave Podcast on YouTube. If you have any questions or a guest request, you can email us at contact@BobWeavePod.com. If you like the show, please take a minute to go on iTunes and rate and review us. On behalf of myself and Zach, we love you guys. Thanks for listening.